Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody here joining us again. We're going to be talking about a different kind of disaster, one we've touched on before, but never really gone deeply into, and I'm looking forward to this conversation tonight. Before we get to that, though, and kind of fill you in on what we're going to be covering, I do want to, as always, bring in my amazing and capable co-host, Sam Bradley. Sam, how you doing?
I'm good, Jamie, and you just never run out of adjectives, and that makes me very happy. You haven't said the same thing twice, I don't think.
I'm a writer, so you know.
Yes, you are. And I've been reading that. We should talk about that later. Anyway, yeah, this hits home for me because it is in my home state. We'll talk about the fires in Northern California and some other ones that have been going on. And we have Dr. Joe with us. Hi, Dr. Joe.
Hey, guys. Good to be back.
You're not worried about fires in Memphis. You're worried about water coming your way. We talked
and
a little about that. Yeah.
And
a little earthquake there, too. Yeah, just to remind you, it's there.
That's right.
But I want to introduce you to Norm Rooker. He's been, this guy's amazing that he can do this for as much as he's been doing this, and he can tell you all about that. But Norm, you're up north right now working on one of the fires up north, are you not?
Yep, the river complex, Willow Creek, California, home of Bigfoot, apparently, although we haven't seen him or her yet.
Here you go.
And a chainsaw.
You got a Sasquatch up there just like we do, only we can't find him right now, so he might pop in later. So tell us about what you do when things aren't on fire. What is your life like? What has your career been like? What do you do?
Okay. Well, I've had the good fortune to be a paramedic. This is my 42nd year, so I'm semi-retired. I work part-time for a critical care transport service to keep my skills and credentials up. And during the wildfire season, I go out as either a line paramedic or an information officer. And this has been a very busy season. So,
yes, it has. And it seems like once those fires started up north, they just kept going and kept going. And how many days has it been since that original Lake County fire started?
I don't know about the Lake County fire. I was on the Lake Fire outside of Big Bear, and I was dispatched on that June 12th, and I've only been home 5 days since then.
Oh, that's brutal. So tell us what your day's like. When you get up in the morning, what do you do?
We have morning briefing at 0600, where the day crews get their assignments on what was going on with the fire the night before. What are the objectives? Do we have the resources to realistically achieve them? What are the dangers and watchouts? The fire I'm on has an IMET, an incident meteorologist, a specially trained NOAA weather forecaster, who is able to do spot forecasts and really give us a warning, because the three things for fire are topography, fuels, and weather. And help us avoid some of the situations, unfortunately, like happened last week in Twist, in avoiding getting caught in weather change and getting burnt over.
Yeah, that was brutal. And that's I've lost track of them, but there's been quite a few guys lost this year on any number of different fires. You were telling me we are really shorthanded. I mean, it's just been beating everybody up locally. We brought in firefighters from all over the place, right?
That's correct. We've got five crews plus a bunch of fixed-wing aircraft down from Canada. And I put those pictures of the water bombers dipping in the lake up on Facebook last week. They're bringing in crews from Australia and New Zealand. Across the U.S., we are tapped out. We have over 32,000 firefighters deployed on over 160 major and moderate-sized fires. There is just not the resources to adequately staff every one. And all of those, getting back to what I do, is as a line paramedic, I'm wildland firefighter qualified. I pass the arduous pack test every year, 3 miles, carrying 45-pound pack in 45 minutes or less. And you have to walk it. They don't allow you to run it. Frankly, at my age, I just don't run. And I have the medic kit, and I'm assigned to a division, and my job is to keep the firefighters as healthy as possible during the workday, watch out for what's going on. And a lot of what I deal with are heat dehydration issues this time of year. Also, they're just starting to get plumb exhausted and wore out by the time we're in this part of fire season. So I might advise division supervisor to rotate a crew, give them a lighter assignment or something to give them a chance to recover for a day or two. And then up here in Northern California, we've got lots of poison oak. And to the south of us, a complex, and it's not that the folks are rolling in, it's just that it burns and the sap is not destroyed by the heat of the fire. It gets aerosolized in the smoke. And just yesterday, we got a report of, I'm not sure which, there's five complexes up here. A complex, the one I'm on was 18 fires that merged together in the one. 200 firefighters had to be taken off the line and go to clinics or hospitals for poison oak exposure. So part of us is keeping them healthy and recognizing, oh, we got a problem. Let's get in and take care of this once early. And every now and again, we'll get trauma or dehydration. But most of us is the wellness help in my job out here.
So let me throw this at Dr. Joe. What do you know clinically, Joe, about the, because people don't think about poison oak being aerosolized and getting into your lungs. What can you tell us about that?
Well, that's exactly what I was just thinking about. You know, I can see folks kind of rolling their eyes and going, oh my gosh, they got an itchy rash. How terrible. But you know, you're right. You can imagine that significant inflammatory process with all the swelling and, itching and inflammatory mediators that are being released by exposure to that. But all of that stuff is happening down inside your airways, you know, the back of your throat, inside your nose, et cetera. So it can be a pretty substantial medical issue for those guys.
And I got to tell you, even on the skin, I've worked as a state employee here in California on some of these Heart Large campaigns, and it's no joke. I mean, those guys are out there for 24 hours, and they are flat miserable. In fact, Northern California is really bad about that. When we had, I think it was 2007 or 8, they we had another, much like this year, just a number of fires that grew together. And you know, when you think about where guys put their hands, that's not someplace you want poison oak. And they couldn't be more miserable, I got to tell you. By the time they get off the line after 24 hours, they're just, you can't even imagine. You just can't imagine. So, Norm, I get the impression you're doing sort of a wilderness level of medicine out there. What do you carry with you in your pack?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because the standard EMT or paramedic training is aimed at the urban-suburban model, and you have an ambulance full of gear, or there'll be two medics and a crew of four firefighters, the surround-and-drown method of medicine, that you have lots of resources that you can bring right there. Out here, it's just what I can carry on my back, and it's not just the kit. I've got to carry my water, my meal, my survival gear, my fire shelter, et cetera. So my medical pack, and I'm a big guy, so I tend to carry a larger one. I carry 2 liters of IV fluid because I'm dealing with dehydration issues or trauma. I can at least do a little bit. And the only medications I carry are Epi, Benadryl, and Zofran. And ideally, because packing someone out, you get that anti-emetic, anti-nausea, or you're going to fly them out, it makes a world of difference. They would like me to carry pain medications, but going from state to state, that can be a challenge. Mm-hmm. And right now, we've just been avoiding that. I don't carry oxygen unless I'm driving to the scene, because you can't fly with that. I do have a LifePak 10 that's current that if I'm driving, I carry. If I fly, I don't. But I don't carry that in the field. I keep it in the vehicle. And the rest is basic life support supplies. And you go in and you're intelligently using the basics, and just a few interventions. The other thing I do is I survey what the resources are for the crews that I have in my division. And sometimes I'll have an ALS engine with, they'll have their full kit. So that's part of what I do is just who do I have available to assist me in working this? First responders, EMTs, what do you have on your unit, et cetera. So it's not just me showing up as a lone ranger. It's part of a team effort.
So do you
but
sometimes
you don't know it,
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. You don't know if you don't ask, you don't do that survey at the beginning of your watch. And it's going to change as crews are rotated through your assignment. You can't just go, well, yesterday I had this. What do you have today?
So do you get so far up in there that evacuation could be an issue? Because I know you go.
Very much so.
When you think about hotshots, they go into places where you have to drop them from aircraft. How would you get somebody out in a scenario like that?
Okay. Okay. First of all, the purists, the hotshots are the infantry. They're very elite. The smoke jumpers, who are recruited from the hotshot ranks, they're the ones that actually jump in, and frequently you'll scout out a hell of a spot. Where you would have to do landing or evacuation. And that's part of what goes on. In the fire service, Wildland Fire Service, we have LCES, lookouts, communications, escape routes, and safety zones. And you establish that in every area you're working on. And that's part of how I got injured on Snag Canyon fire last year, was I was scouting out a section of line that was too steep to bring someone up. For a hell of a spot down below, and some rocks were dislodged, and I wasn't able to dodge all of them. And fortunately, it didn't break my femur, but I sure thought it did.
Ouch.
And that is part of the issue we're having this year, is dislodged rocks by the fire and falling trees. And because it's so drought stress, fourth year of drought across the Northwest, even live trees, which normally you can have some trust in, in the high winds, et cetera, are dropping. And on this fire alone, we've had two vehicles struck by falling trees, and we've had to transport out two firefighters struck by boulders rolling down. One of them, it hit him in the chest and snapped his collarbone.
Ah, boy, that had to be painful. So how many guys are you responsible for on a given day?
Division, it can be as many as 100 or so. Usually it's down around 50 or 60.
Oh, good grief. Jamie, I think you had a question, didn't you?
Well, no, I'm listening to this and it's taking me back to past episodes. And Joe, we've talked about how you manage the health of your crews when your USAR team responds. I'm hearing Norm here talk about similar things that you've touched on in the past about just maintaining general wellness and paying attention to people that are just becoming too exhausted to continue. And here we have firefighters stretched so thin and working so many days straight. Norm's having to, you know, recommend rotating people on and off the line and into different assignments, much like you were talking about with your USAR teams in the past.
Well, it is very similar, and you know, Norm has it in magnitudes of order more difficult, because those guys are in the field for weeks on end in the most austere conditions you can possibly imagine, and those are changing every day based on where the fire is spread to. So kudos to him and his ability to do that. That is a phenomenally difficult and challenging job.
I think you told us, but you didn't mention it here, Norm, how many days you've been out there since June?
all but five. I've had 5 days off since the middle of June. I wanted to touch back on something Dr. Joe said, and he may not remember when we had this conversation. Oklahoma City, one of the challenges the USAR docs had was they had two entire USAR teams go down essentially for an operational period due to camp crud, GI symptoms, because well-meaning folks were showing up trying to show their love, here, would you like some pizza? And part of what the docs had to do was take control of the perimeter, and food only comes through us. And I believe you guys got baby wipes, hand sanitizers, and made sure everyone did that before. Well, camp crud out here, the hand sanitation, both in the camps, we have the wash stations, and that's the constant safety messaging, and right down, the handy wipes are included in the bag lunches. Because, I got someone down, dehydration, and they're blowing and chumming from both ends, and we're spiked out. It gets long.
And it's probably not just one. It probably could affect the whole camp, couldn't it?
Potentially.
Yeah, I remember that going back to the Cedar Fire, where a lot of well-meaning folks would come in with food, but yeah, you know, as well-meaning as they are, you really don't know how long it's been sitting there, and it could be a problem. And one thing about the fires, they do feed you very well out there. I know certainly the Cal Fire generated fires that I worked on certainly do.
It's a real challenge to not insult the local folks who are, you know, doing their best to try to help and want to contribute in some sort of way and are, you know, only meaning the absolute best that they can mean. Yet just due to the austere environment and the challenges associated with that, you know, that food gets contaminated very quickly and very easily. And, you know, a whole team goes down very, very, very hard over something like that.
Yeah, it's just like go ahead, Norm.
I was going to say the humorous side of this last fire season, the entire incident management team was taken out for an operational cycle because someone brought in from the community a tray of brownies, and it was those kind of brownies. So they were out for different reasons. Yeah.
Wow. The team that's supposed to know better, right? Yeah.
Oh, I can imagine what that was like. Well, I hear that Sasquatch has returned. Jim Logan.
Sorry about that. Yeah. Hey, Norm, how are you?
Very good. Welcome back, brother.
No, thank you so much. Thanks for joining us. So the question is, are you wearing your kilt?
I will be. Remember, September is kilted month. This is still August.
It is. That's right.
But I'll have it on. I'll have it on there in Las Vegas.
Perfect.
That is
perfect.
Not something you'd want to wear where he is. That's a little scary.
Yeah.
We'll look forward to that, though, Norman, September when we see you. So, Jim, you're going to wear one?
No, not at all.
No. Okay, we got that. Well, we were just talking about a day in the life and some of the challenges that Norm is facing back there, trying to keep these very tired guys well, much less dealing with all the injuries and poison oak and everything else. Are they working 24s, Norm? Or have you
No, we have day ops and night ops. In the Wildland Fire Service, you have a 2-to-1 work ratio. So 16 hours total, meals, travel, work on the line, travel back to camp, servicing equipment, down for 8 hours. And this, like a lot of the other lessons in wildland fire suppression, are things we've learned. They've been paid for in blood. You know, we're not going to have people dying because of exhaustion. They fall asleep at the wheel. They're making foolish mistakes. So if it's running and gunning and you have to work 24, 36 hours, you then have to mitigate that crew, get them rested up before you put them back at it. It's still 14 straight days of 16-hour work days. Gets tiring.
So what is that the usual deployment for most of these guys coming up from city departments and so forth? Is it 2 weeks, 14 days?
Yeah, you take the assignment with a 14-day commitment, and they may extend, like I'm extending an extra 7 on this one, and then I've got to do 2 days of mandatory rest before I can go back available again. Or if they were to extend me 2 weeks, they have to give me 2 days R&R in there before they pick me back up on the line. And that's what happened to me in Idaho. Was I worked not quite 3 weeks. I had 2.5 days of R&R in Missoula, and then right back out for another 2 weeks.
Yes, isn't that? I'm not sure how VMAT is, Sam, but that's pretty similar to the way USAR operates its teams as well, as far as work time, downtime, rehab time, those elements. So it's a pretty good formula, works well. And you're right, you don't want to work your guys and gals to death, because that's dangerous.
Well, and the bottom line is there, and Joe could certainly attest to this, they're much more prone to injury and illness if their immune systems are broken down, and they're just not thinking straight. I mean, your brain can only cope with so much when it's tired, and fatigue, as we know in EMS, fatigue equates to bad things happening to people, and that sounds like what you're trying to prevent, Norm.
Yes. Like you said, fatigue, poor patient care, poor firefighting decisions that makes things that otherwise we know suddenly seem like a good idea just because I'm tired and damn it, we want to get it over. Pardon me, my cursing there. So, yes.
And people take shortcuts. And, you got to think of the different kinds of tools those guys are using out there. They got chainsaws and things with sharp, pointy ends on them. And, you know, that's, I remember, again, from my experience working fires, those sharp, pointy things getting stuck into people that weren't paying attention, or the guy that was wielding wasn't paying attention. So that's going to even be worse when they're not thinking straight.
Correct.
So how much actual trauma are you dealing with out there? What kind of things are you seeing?
Trauma-wise, in the 5 years I've been doing this, I've only had one chainsaw injury, and it was among a fresh Type 2 IA crew, so they weren't very experienced. IA stands for initial attack. So that's the lowest experience level of the hand crews. And someone turned, not thinking with the saw, rather than just turning their head, and quick clot gauze was used in that one, and it worked effectively. I've had a couple of just standard motor vehicle accidents where I've worked, and so we could get an ambulance out there and take over doing that. Most of what I'm dealing with trauma-wise are blisters. Primarily hands and feet, and oddly enough, boils. I have seen more yucky boils due to forfeiting equipment and wearing the same clothing without having the opportunity to change, so that that friction along with the body soils really makes for a bad combination. And it's almost always on the young kids that don't want to seem like they're the weak link, and among newer women firefighters, because they don't want to be perceived as a weak link, and they're looked at, they're held to a higher standard and lower tolerance the first year or two than their male counterparts. And so conversely, they're the ones we got to watch the closest, because they don't want to appear. They'll try and suck it up and suck it up. And that's the kid that drops from heat stroke. That's the kid that won't show that they've got problems. Because 2012, I had to take a septic shock, and it was a first year hot shot. And he didn't want to let his team down. And he just kept, it's just a cold. It's just a cold. It's just a cold. And they were spiked out. And I got called off the line, and it was 2 hours till I could get that kid into the hospital. So it's dealing with those kinds of things and those mindsets that makes it a challenge.
It sounds very similar to guys in the military that don't want to look weak. So, Joe, what about boils? Do you see that kind of thing when you're on a USAR deployment? That's you know, I've seen them on fires, but I didn't give much thought as to how they get there.
Oh, we absolutely do, for exactly the same reason. You know, it's a wet boot or glove or whatever with you know, dirt and ash and all kinds of stuff that gets in there, and you know, you're out there on the line and you don't want to stop and take a look at it, and so you just push on through the day, and by the end of the day you've got a blister that's gotten secondarily infected, or you've embedded a bunch of foreign debris down into the skin, and that leads to infections, et cetera.
Or the field treatment. I'll put duct tape on it, and then they come to us, and we got to rip that off.
Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? Yikes.
So I don't know if the fire line, wildland fires like you saw, but you know, we have to remind the guys to change your socks and those kind of things. You know, dry socks, dry clothes, all that stuff. But I think, you know, you have a packing list in USAR that you have so many socks, so many underwear. And what the younger inexperienced folks don't do is pack things of comfort from home. Like, let's say, for your downtime, tennis shoes, flip-flops, jeans, those. And they have to end up wearing their boots because they made the mistake of not, you know, bringing those creature comforts, if you will. To give their feet and you know, body that downtime and that rest.
Well, in some cases, Jim, they don't get a whole lot of notice. I know several departments that's like, okay, you're up, you're going right now, and they bring what they got at the station, and they end up sleeping on the hose bed, you know?
I agree that you sign up for these teams just like in USAR, and so you know. So for me, when I was deployable, I would have my go bag of my required equipment, and then I would have gym stuff, right? Because we've been on these deployments, right, and we know what we need. We know that we want to pack our old moleskin for our feet in case we get a hot spot, need to put it on there. So it's about, yeah, on these deployments, it's about taking care of yourself.
And we D-manners have learned that very well. We always have our personal stuff packed and our certainly moleskin and those kinds of things, because we know we're going to do a lot of walking around in boots. But like I said, with these fire guys, especially the new ones, they haven't learned that yet. It takes years, yes, to kind of learn from other people. Would you agree, Norm, what you need and what you don't need? I mean, we used to have people coming with all of their electronic equipment, and guess what? You're going to be packing that stuff all over the place. Everywhere you go, it's going with you, and you're going to have it on your back. So sometimes you got to learn that the hard way, wouldn't you agree?
Good judgment is what you get for surviving bad judgment. Hopefully someone else's, not yours, but yeah.
That's
now, with
it.
That said, here at this fire camp, and this is a Type 1 incident, they've got a charging station set up. They've got a table with all of these outlets hooked up to a generator that also runs the night lights, and it's specifically for charging up their tablets, their phones, their this, their that, while they're out on the line. So they come back in, and they've got fully charged stuff. It was the first fire I've seen that on, but then again, it's California. So what can I say?
Well, and some of that is, you know, to increase the mental health capabilities. You know, that helps to deal with the fatigue. Is giving your brain some downtime to, you know, take your mind off of what you're doing.
Absolutely.
Not to mention the communication home. That's important too. And for those guys that have kids now, they have FaceTime, and at least they can see them, which we didn't have years ago. So, good point. And we didn't used to have all those outlets either. I'm really glad to hear they fixed that problem.
Well, at least this camp they did. I can't say that for all of them.
No, good deal, because that was one of the big issues with DMAT, is just there's just never enough plugs for everybody's stuff. So anyway, so that's a day in the life. I think people don't appreciate, I mean, I work mostly with Cal Fire, so I know how their setup is, and it's amazing how fast, when they set up a command post, how well organized and how fast that becomes a virtual city. And
yes,
people kind of wonder, what's it like out there? Well, they bring in trailers that are personal showers. They have either huge tents or, in some cases, hotels, depending on where they are and what's available. They feed you like a king 24 hours a day, at least when you're in the command post. You're never at there's never a lack of food. It's truly amazing. It's not as, even though you're on an austere environment, they have it down to such a science. It's pretty amazing. I don't know what your setup up there is like, but.
Well, that's like you said, we come in, we set up a small town. You have the business section with all of the government functions, communications, payroll, information, the incident commanders, plans, the weather folks, the mapping folks, the print shops. And then you have the support services, just like the military. So you've got the caterers and the dining facility. They'll have portable shower units. The larger fires will also have laundry service, so you can get your laundry done, 24-hour turnaround while you're here. Fuel support for fueling the vehicles and vehicle inspection. And some places will contract with folks that can do minor repairs right there. And then you have the sleeping areas designated around. So you've got the porta potties all around and the hand wash stations. It literally, you know, we'll take over a school or a rodeo fairground, or we'll be out in the middle of a field. I've gone to some places where it's not even addressed. It's just lat long, and I program that in my Garmin. Like, okay, I guess I'm here. And you're running off generators, or they'll string power in, et cetera, to make it work. And it's a temporary setup for a few weeks or a few months, and then, like gypsies, we're gone and on to the next one.
That's right. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up here pretty quickly, but just in general, how contained are the fires up there? I haven't heard lately. How close are they to getting some control over it?
There's five complexes up here plus four smaller fires. Two of the complexes are 80% or more contained. The one I'm on is 26% contained, but we also have a bunch of earlier fire scars surrounding us, so the fire is bumping up against them and slowing down on its own. Mother Nature's containing those parts or slowing them down. And then we've got three fires that are just ripping and roaring, and they're getting most of the attention. That's here in Northern California. Washington, Idaho, Montana, if you look at the national map, it looks like the country's got a case of measles up there. They're so polka dotted with fires.
Yeah, and hopefully, the Pacific Northwest, I think, in the next 3 or 4 days is due for some rain. I think you guys are all hoping that comes in sooner than later. But so hopefully one of those Pacific typhoons has hit the coast of Japan and then swung all the way around to the north and back down again onto the west coast of the U.S. or is planning to do that. And so hopefully you guys are going to get some rain and give you a little bit of a respite.
Well, we'll see. Right now we have a 20% chance, according to our incident meteorologist. We'll see how that improves. And if it does come, we'd like a gentle soaking rain, not the big gully washers, and definitely no more lightning.
Oh, yeah.
I hear you. You know, Joe, this just, it's been great having Norm here talking, but you and Jim, this is the type of experience that you need to hear about and learn from. And like Norm said, you learn hopefully from someone else's mistakes. And I think that's kind of what you guys are all about over at Paragon Medical Education Group, where you're talking about, taking lessons learned from someone else in actual disaster and response situations and passing that valuable knowledge on to responders who haven't yet experienced something like that.
Well, I think you're exactly right. I think it also goes to show that there are a lot of common principles and applicable knowledge across many, many disciplines. And, Norm's a perfect example of that. So it's part of what we do is to try to incorporate all of those different disciplines and all the training that we do.
So where can folks find you guys if they want to find out about some of the excellent training that you guys put on in Paragon? I know you're going to be out at EMS World Expo in a little bit to do some special events some research-based experiential examination or examples of some things you're doing out there. But we've got some things coming up at other conferences, and of course you can come into someone's area. So where can they find more about you if they want to contact you?
Well, they can certainly reach us through the Disaster Podcast, but they can find us on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU, or our website is ParagonMedicalGroup.com, or on Facebook under the same name, Paragon Medical Group.
Excellent. And we do appreciate your support, the Disaster Podcast and our whole Disaster Podcast community, because we've really got an active group of audience members here that have checked out the show. And Norm, I just want to thank you again for coming on the show. We give you, as many of our guests, but especially for you, a standing invitation. If there's something you'd like to talk about, maybe an event or something that you ran into that you think our audience could benefit from, we'd love to have you back on the show sometime.
Absolutely.
All right. I look forward to that. I'll see you all in Las Vegas in a month.
That sounds good.
Or less, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's coming up quick.
Closer to 2 weeks.
Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, in the usual social media places, Sam Bradley, Sam Bradley 11, Twitter, Facebook, and certainly the disasterpodcast.com. And I look forward to seeing Norm and his kilt in 2 weeks.
And of course,
it'll be my pleasure, Les.
You can find me over under the handle Podmedic in most places on social media. And I always look forward to catching up with folks at EMS World Expo and all the conferences. So, Norm, I'm looking forward to meeting you face-to-face and chatting with you over there. And we're definitely going to have to have you in and do maybe a little segment in our podcast studio for the Disaster Podcast episode while you're there. For folks out there that are in the audience, you know, we want you to, you know, you like what you hear Norm talking about, let us know. Leave a comment on this episode and let us know what you like to hear more of and what maybe a question you had that we didn't ask Norm. That's an opportunity for you to do that. We can reach out to him and get an answer for you and leave it back in the comments there so that everybody can see the answer. So head over to disasterpodcast.com. And of course, if you have a question on this or any of the episodes, leave them there in the comments below each episode. That's it for me. You know, Sam, Norm has outlined yet again the just challenges for austere medical care.
Yeah, whether it's hurricanes, earthquakes, or wildfires, disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.